Snyder slams the United States for distorting reality and inverting the truth and claiming to be a supporter of human rights. Amnesty International accuses Myanmar's military of adopting battle tactics against protesters as 8 more demonstrators are killed in Thursday's rallies. And Japan marks 10 years since Fukushima's powerful earthquake, deadly tsunami, and nuclear meltdown that traumatized the nation. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while backing those who violate them. Ayatollah Khamenei said Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen for 6 years and the UN and the US have been silent towards its crimes. However, he said Washington and the United Nations are prompt enough to condemn Yemenis when they launch retaliatory attacks against Riyadh. Iran's leader also slammed the U.S. for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed the U.S. presence in Syria, arguing that Washington created a military base there without the permission of Damascus. He called for the withdrawal of American forces from Syria and Iraq. Iran's leader also rejected a U.S. claim that the Islamic Republic's regional presence is destabilizing. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Iran's regional presence in non-military ones. He also criticized the U.S. for having the world's largest nuclear arsenal. Iran's leader said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons, and now it claims that it's against weapons of mass destruction. Political commentator Mohammad Marandi says Ayatollah Khamenei tried to convey to the audience in his recent remarks that Iran's policies are based on religious and humane principles in support of the oppressed and the deprived.
Basically, my understanding is that he was trying to tell or convey to the audience that the principles that Iran follows are based upon their religious principles, and they are humane principles. And it's not only in support of Muslims or people of our region, but it's the principle is to support the oppressed and the deprived across the world. And the main source of oppression and aggression is, of course, the United States and its allies and proxies across the world. The Western media, their regimes, their think tanks, they create narratives in order to legitimize their horrific policies, in order to legitimize oppression, in order to legitimize colonialism and neocolonialism.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for more humanitarian access to Syria, warning that about 60% of Syrians are at risk of hunger in the current year. Guterres called the situation in the Arab country a living nightmare. He said intensified cross-line and cross-border deliveries are essential to reach everyone in need across Syria. Guterres made the remarks in a statement to mark Syria's decade-long conflict. The Arab country has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since 2011. Damascus says the Israeli regime, the U.S., and their Western and regional allies are aiding terrorist groups that are wreaking havoc in the country. The conflict has killed, wounded, and displaced millions of Syrians and cost billions of dollars in damage. In recent years, Syrian forces have taken back many areas once controlled by foreign-backed terrorists, including Daesh. Palestinian scholars in the Gaza Strip have held a rally in support of the Palestinian cause. The rally is part of Jerusalem Week events underway in the enclave to warn against Israeli attempts to Judaize Jerusalem. Al-Quds. Ruba Shabit has more in this report.
Palestinian scholars in the Gaza Strip held a huge rally to mark Jerusalem Week. Organized by International Union for Muslim Scholars, the rally comes as part of a week-long events and activities in the enclave to warn against Israel's attempts to Judaize Jerusalem Al-Quds.
This rally comes as a part of a series of events held in the enclave to mark Jerusalem Week. It is held each year from 6 to 12 of March. We call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Palestine against the Israeli occupation and never give up defending Al-Quds.
The scholars stress that Muslims feel duty-bound to defend and liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque. They also called on Arab and Muslim scholars, institutions, and organizations to mark this week to raise public awareness of the current situation.
In this week, we stress Jerusalem al-Quds' place in our hearts and how important it is for all Muslims. Palestinians and Arabs should take actions to stop any normalization of ties with Israel, which is seeking to Jewidize Jerusalem al-Quds. The city is important, not only for Palestinians, but for all Muslims.
Palestinians say their resistance will go on and they will defend Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque at all costs.
This rally aims to express support for Al-Quds and show that it is in our minds and hearts. The city has a holy symbolism for all Muslims and we won't accept any attempts to Judaize it.
Israel has occupied Jerusalem al-Quds since June 1967 and practiced all kinds of violations against its people in holy places. Although its annexation of the city is not recognized under international law, people here say they mark International Quds Week in a show of support for the Palestinian struggles against the decades-long Israeli occupation. They call on Arabs and Muslims to mark this week, hoping with Palestinians that Jerusalem al-Quds will be free. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
China has called on the United States to bring the bilateral relations between the two countries on the right track. The Chinese Foreign Ministry urged the U.S. to view ties between Beijing and Washington objectively and rationally. It also called on the U.S. to stop interfering in China's internal affairs. The comments were made following a series of remarks by the U.S. Secretary of State regarding China. Antony Blinken earlier expressed concerns about China's actions, saying they challenged the security and values of Washington and its allies. American and Chinese officials are scheduled to hold a diplomatic meeting next week in Alaska, which will be the first since President Joe Biden entered the White House. Fresh anti-coup protests have been held in several parts of Myanmar despite an increasingly brutal crackdown by the military. At least 8 protesters have reportedly been killed after security forces attacked marchers in several regions, including the commercial hub of Yangon. Protesters were calling for the return of civilian rule and the release of detained officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The Southeast Asian nation has been in turmoil since the military overthrew the government over allegations of voter fraud. In the last parliamentary elections, nearly 70 protesters have been killed and 1,900 others have been arrested since the coup. Amnesty International has condemned the crackdown on protests. The rights group accuses the army of using lethal force, saying many of the killings amounted to extrajudicial executions. Phil Robertson, the deputy director of Human Rights Watch's Asia division, says the international community has been slow to respond to the situation in Myanmar.
It's quite clearly been too slow, although we did see yesterday a joint statement that came out of a pretty bitterly divided UN Security Council, which stated very clearly that there had to be release of imprisoned leaders, including Aung San Suu Kyi. There has to be action to restrain the armed forces and to end the violence. But, you know, you essentially have the U.S., the U.K., and France wanting to do much more, and China and Russia resisting action and wanting to look the other way on what the military is doing to the people of Myanmar. You know, and it's unclear that we're going to be able to get much more action beyond that. I think we may see individual countries take action, and we're waiting for the European Union to come out with a package of targeted sanctions on top military leaders and also those military companies that I mentioned, but it still hasn't happened yet.
Japan has observed a moment's silence to mark the 10th anniversary of an earthquake and tsunami that devastated the country's northeastern coast, including a nuclear plant. In a ceremony held in the capital, Tokyo, Emperor Naruhito delivered a speech To the families of the victims, Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga also used the occasion to pledge for reviewing his country's disaster prevention policies. He said he would work for making a country resilient to disaster. People nationwide also held commemoration events. A powerful quake and tsunami in 2011 caused a meltdown at Fukushima nuclear plant, triggering the world's worst nuclear disaster since the 1986 Chernobyl crisis. More than 18,000 people lost their lives in that incident. The crude prices in India have skyrocketed in recent weeks, putting common man in a tremendous pressure. The fuel price has been one of the key poll issues used by opposition parties in the five poll-bound states to corner the ruling BJP. One Hour Zaman reports from New Delhi.
Crude oil is considered one of the backbones of the Indian economy, and recent months have seen a sharp rise in the crude prices. Petrol prices are at an all-time high in the state of Mumbai, while diesel, the main driver of industrial activity, is being sold for more than 88 rupees a litre, raising transportation costs. The government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi for now has shifted the blame for high prices on previous governments and production cuts by some oil-exporting nations.
Experts say the rising crude prices will put pressure on the country's economy that's heavily dependent on imports and has just recovered from a deep recession following COVID-19 pandemic, which shattered the world economy.
While many experts believe that the government could cut taxes on petrol and diesel ahead of election in five key states, they, however, warn that the persistent higher prices could lead to inflation, which could threaten the path to recovery. They say both state and central government should act swiftly.
Prices are at historic high. Now, both the state governments and the central governments, they both will have to jointly come with reduction. Now, state governments have their own issues, and they, despite the fact that all the opposition parties, they are trying to make out a case for reduction, but they are not acting.
While the revenues gained from taxes on retail fuel is key for government to boost spending in the economy that exited a rare recession, the central bank sees those levies along with elevated crude prices a benefit. But experts say any withdrawal of the easy monetary policies to combat price growth will lead to a spike in borrowing costs, in turn hurting consumption and business activity at a time when millions of Indians are still out of work due to pandemic. Experts say the turmoil in West Asia is also a factor driving oil prices, especially for India, which is import-driven economy. Meanwhile, a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development predicts India will be among the large economies most severely hit by the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown restrictions to combat it. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The European Union is getting increasingly defensive of its vaccine rollout process as it's slammed its sluggish by member states. A fraction of the bloc's population has been vaccinated so far as it's facing production and distribution hiccups. New controls on exports have been put in place to prevent doses leaving the EU as it scrambles to catch up with the UK and the US and be ready to jumpstart the economy, Priyanka Rahimi reports.
The EU has faced production problems with the Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna and Oxford AstraZeneca vaccines, blocking shipments to places like Australia amid shortages. Meanwhile, the European Council has accused the UK of imposing an outright ban on the export of COVID-19 vaccines to the bloc. The UK's Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has written to set the record straight, saying the claims are false, but the European Council President doesn't seem convinced.
Glad if the UK reaction leads to more transparency and increased exports to EU and third countries. Different ways of imposing bans or restrictions on vaccines and medicines. EU is providing vaccines for its citizens and the rest of the world. No one is safe until everyone is safe.
For many member states, why the EU's vaccine procurement and distribution process is waning does not really matter. They want to stop the dying, reignite their battered economies, and secure election votes. so they're looking elsewhere for supplies. Hungary got its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine on the 4th of March, and in just a week has made good on its promise to become one of the bloc's most vaccinated countries. The EU has not approved the Russian jab, but on Tuesday, Moscow signed a deal to produce 10 million doses of Sputnik V in Italy by July.
I believe that this is a historic agreement because it sees Italy as the first in the European context to enter into such an important agreement for the production of Sputnik in Italy.
The retail, entertainment, tourism and airline industries are desperate to get back on track and mitigate their lockdown losses. But for that to happen, enough people need to be inoculated. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has chided the EU for the slow pace of its vaccine drive. On the other hand, it has forecast a rapid economic recovery for the UK, which has given one in three adults their first dose. The OECD says speed is of the essence and is urging the EU to get on a war footing when it comes to vaccine distribution. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The opposition in Venezuela has been divided into two sectors, the moderate one that supports elections and the radical one that boycotts the vote and asks for a U.S. intervention to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. Meanwhile, the ruling Socialist Party seems to garner people's support to win this year's regional elections. From Caracas, Piteso Silva reports.
These days in Venezuela, analysts say that political division prevails within the nation's opposition, as one sector is regarded as moderate and proposes resolving the national problems electorally and without the U.S. intervention, while the other sector is considered as the radical one and is asking for a U.S. intervention to finish off by force the presidency of socialist leader Nicolas Maduro. As the Bolivarian Republic organizes regional elections this year, members of the moderate opposition are already calling on all citizens to participate in such elections, claiming that voting is the only way to make a positive change in Venezuela.
The solution to the country's current crisis is at the hands of voters by electing new governors and mayors this year.
But on the opposition known as radical, which includes hardliner Juan Guaido, relations are still strong with the U.S., and therefore the proposal is urging Washington to implement tougher economic sanctions against the Maduro administration. This side of the opposition alleges all elections are a sham, and for such reason, a military intervention by the U.S. is needed to overthrow Maduro.
We will boycott these elections since Maduro has control of the Electoral Top Council. The U.S. and its allies know that there is no democracy in this nation.
Meanwhile, government officials dismiss the accusations against the electoral system.
The U.S.-backed opposition is telling lies about their elections because they are being paid by the U.S. government to boycott elections. There is no evidence of fraud.
Caracas says that leaders of the U.S.-backed opposition will soon be held accountable over helping Washington in the confiscation of Venezuela's assets abroad, which has deeply harmed the economy of the Latin American country. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The reason why the enemies show hostility towards the Islamic government. During the sacred defense era, the Ashura army was a courageous and innovative army, and Shahid Bakiri is also an unforgettable personality who will never be forgotten. His close friends, of course, I saw him many times as well, and those who were with him narrate such things about his enlightenment, his spirituality, and his warmth that one really envies him. Later on, during the sedition of Khalq-e-Musulman, it was the people of Tabriz themselves who responded. Those who had caused the sedition of Khalq-e-Musulman used to have the notion that they were going to do something for Azerbaijan. But it was the people themselves who stood up against the sedition, and it was they who prevented them from succeeding. At that time, Imam said the same thing. He said that no one needs to do anything as the people of Tabriz would respond to them on their own. Also in subsequent years, in the sedition of the year of 1388, the people of Tabriz entered the arena and foiled the plot one day sooner than the people of Tehran, and one day sooner than other people throughout the country.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Faith to be stronger.
These were some points about the 29th of Bahman of 1356. And about the significance and greatness of that event. We should never forget it. Now, what lesson should we learn from that event? This is my main discussion. What is the lesson that we should learn from it today? Well, from the beginning, the Islamic Revolution faced the enmity of superpowers, and a certain front came into being. When I say superpowers, I mean the Soviet Union of those days as well as the US. They had disagreements with one another over hundreds of matters. But they had an agreement with one another over the issue of confronting the Islamic Republic, the Islamic Revolution, and the system established by the Imam. The same was true of European powers. The same was true of their cohorts, regional reactionaries and others. A front against the Islamic Revolution came into being. Well, what was the reason for their enmity? This is a point that we should never forget.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
The future of the U.S. military budget hangs in the balance. This as President Joe Biden is following in the footsteps of his predecessor Donald Trump by refusing to cut the 2021 military spending. Officials have reported that Biden is postponing a reset of priorities as part of the Pentagon's expenditure, which is due on May 3rd. The budget will come in at just over $696 billion. That means the national security budgets, including the Department of Energy's outlay, could total more than $735 billion. The figure is comparable to the base funding provided to the Pentagon in 2021. Biden's decision is likely to draw criticism from his own so-called progressive supporters. But a major reduction in the budget is highly unlikely. That's because Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are slim, and not all Democrats agree to cutting military budgets significantly. That's according to Center for Strategic and International Studies paper. On the other hand, Joe Biden, like his predecessor, seems to have caved in to the military and defense contractors. Hence, no drawdown in the number of U.S. bases or troops overseas.
Those of us in the peace movement are very concerned about this because, on the one hand, he talked during his campaign and continues to talk about wanting to end these endless wars. And yet, if he's not going to bring troops out of Iraq or Afghanistan, how's he going to end the wars? We're also concerned about the airstrikes that have been going on because he has continued the policy of Donald Trump, which is not to publish any of the statistics about U.S. airstrikes. So it's not just the troops, it's the bombing that we want to stop.
American arms companies spend millions of dollars every year lobbying politicians and donating to their campaigns. According to figures by OpenSecret.org, top contributors to federal candidates, parties, and outside groups include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and Northrop Grumman, with each contributing more than $5 million. The total contribution makes up to $45 million, which has a direct impact on U.S. war decisions and troop deployments abroad. The USA Today has revealed Washington's so-called war on terror has affected 85 countries in the last 3 years alone. The newspaper also says over 19 years after the September 11 attacks, America is still entangled in conflict in West Asia and beyond, and there is still no end in sight to the unpopular wars.
It seems like no president wants to upset the status quo of the continued war machine. They don't want to go up against the weapons industry, they don't want to go against the hawks in Congress, and they don't want to be responsible for, quote, losing a war. But the U.S. has lost these wars a long time ago, and the only thing we're doing now is expending precious resources and lives in a continued failed effort.
But why does the U.S. insist on continuing these wars in spite of the fact that they have proven to be futile?
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, it's pretty clear that the Taliban control most of the country now. And if the U.S. leaves, because the government that the U.S. has been supporting for almost 20 years is very corrupt and doesn't have a large base of support, and the military that the U.S. has been training for almost 20 years is not capable of fighting the Taliban, the Taliban will have even more power once the U.S. leaves, and no U.S. president wants to be responsible for that. In the case of Iraq, it's quite similar. The U.S. is supporting governments that can't stand up on their own. And so if the U.S. leaves, these governments will probably be overtaken by other groups, and nobody in the White House wants to be responsible for that.
Apart from the suffering the conflict inflicted on target nations, the U.S. itself paid dearly for its wars. America has spent a whopping $7 trillion in taxpayers' money on the wars after the 9/11 attacks of 2001. That's not just about treasure, but blood. The U.S. has lost more than 4,500 soldiers in Iraq since 2003. The number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan as of 2001 stands at nearly 2,500. Those tallies are based on official figures. Some observers say the real death toll might be way higher. But there are no signs that the U.S. will free itself from the vortex it created in the first place anytime soon.
U.S. airstrike against the positions of anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border last month has opened a debate on the presidential war powers, drawing criticism from several American lawmakers who argued that President Joe Biden must have consulted the Congress before authorizing the raids. But as Tulsi Gabbard, former U.S. Congresswoman from Hawaii, has pointed out, the bigger picture is being missed by many.
The regime change war the United States continues to wage in Syria, using al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, HTS terrorists as our proxy ground force, and who now occupy and control the city of Idlib.
Gabbard also drew a parallel between the crippling U.S. sanctions on Syria and the U.S.-Saudi sanctions on Yemen, saying the embargo is threatening the lives of millions of Syrians and preventing the war-torn country from reconstruction.
In terms of the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard, in my view, she's been attacked because she's anti-war, because she has been honest about U.S. foreign policy. She's been honest about the fact that the U.S. has been supporting groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. She has called for the end of the U.S. forever wars in the Middle East. And that's the third rail of American politics. That's something that both parties agree on, that those wars should continue. And that's why she's attacked.
Since ordering the air raids on Syria, President Biden has also been criticized for keeping up America's interventionist policy in Syria and following in the footsteps of his hawkish predecessor, former President Donald Trump, who publicly bragged that the U.S. military was deployed in Syria to take the Arab country's oil.
And then they say he left troops in Syria. You know what I did? I left troops to take the oil. I took the oil. The only troops I have are taking the oil.
Biden's ordering the attack less than 2 months into his presidency has raised the question, is the U.S. West Asia policy ever going to change? The U.S. and its allies' support for terrorists in West Asia is no news, as many current and former American officials have acknowledged who has been behind a multitude of crises in the region. In a speech at the Institute of Politics at the Harvard University in 2014, then-Vice President Joe Biden painted a clear picture of what had been happening in Syria behind the scenes.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spend a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Well, I think Biden ultimately would like regime change in Syria, though I think that he understands that that's probably a remote chance. I think that the U.S. will settle for the Balkanization of Syria.
In addition, Donald Trump alleged in numerous instances during the 2016 presidential campaign that then-President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton founded the Daesh terror group.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
But not only none of those speeches resulted in any de-escalation in Syria, the U.S. exacerbated the situation further by pressing ahead with its anti-Damascus policies. One of the recent instances of which was Donald Trump signing into law the CSAR Act in 2020, which imposed a set of draconian economic sanctions on Syria. The conflict in Syria has left a trail of death and destruction in its wake. The West's sanctions and attacks conducted by Israel on the U.S. are hindering any attempts to rebuild the Arab nation.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, arrived at Baghdad International Airport
on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace, saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kademi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the presidential palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction, and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
So the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace. There is a great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center Twin Buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. But here again, we have a great, if you like, emotional, positive emotional image of the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, and the leader of chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together, expressing what they have in common, and being, in a way, friends, and affirming a message of which is common to both religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotionally passionate.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
And if the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased? And they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the UN body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessing be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, we are still continuing our discussion on the doubts and misconceptions raised on the existence of mother of Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and if she was a Roman lady or Arab lady, a black or white lady. These are the actually, unfortunately, doubts that we need to answer in order to enlighten our brothers and sisters in faith with regard to these, to say that this is also impossible. We said that the story of a lady coming from Rome is not impossible in a sense. It can happen anyhow. But if the story is true or not, this is not a matter, and this is not a matter of discussion in Shia worldview and in Shia tradition. The topic that we need to discuss with presence of Islamic scholar from Qom Seminary School, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is the knowledge of unseen of Imam Hadi alayhi salam or any other imam of Ahlul Bayt. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me. Unfortunately, when it comes to Ilmul Ghaib, again, we see that some of the Wahhabi scholars, they only pay attention to some verses of the Quran and ignore the others, and also ignore the narrations, not in Shia sources, but rather in their own sources, I mean the Sunni sources. Even a great Sunni scholar like Fakhr Razi claimed that the knowledge of unseen is not limited to the prophets.
Right.
Secondly, Fakhr Razi continues, all the followers of religion, this is very interesting, all the followers of different religions and schools of thought, they believe that some dreams are true, and we have the ilm, a science, a field of study, which is about interpretation of the dream, and some people are able to tell you about the future through the dreams. This is Fakhr Razi referring to the fact that knowledge of the unseen is not limited to the prophets. This is the second point, and then he mentions other point, third and fourth. So, you see, even according to Sunni scholars, it's not limited to the Prophet.
So we need just to tell this respected critic to study your lesson as well.
Exactly, that's the point.
First, refer to the sources, to the interpreters of both the schools, and then come and say something. So you need to know first what you have as a base, then you can mention an idea and work on that idea and claim it.
And not only that, there are stories about the second caliph again, that he had also the knowledge of the unseen. The next point again is that if you want to say that according to the verse of the Noble Book of Quran, only the prophets, they had access to the knowledge of the unseen, then what about the narrations in Sunni sources which tell you that, for example, the second caliph, he had the knowledge of the unseen as well?
Yeah.
There is an interesting narration in Ustul Ghaba, volume 2, page 244, that once the second caliph, of course, as Shia, we do not necessarily believe in these narrations, these are in Sunni sources, but we want to prove for this Wahhabi scholar that these are mentioned in your own books,
mm-hmm.
which means that knowledge of the unseen is not limited to the Prophet.
Very true.
He was giving a sermon on Friday in Salatul Jum'ah. Suddenly, he said that something like that, Sariya Kuh Kuh. And people asked for the reason that why did you mention that? And it seemed that it was not in Arabic language. And he said that it came to my mind that the polytheists want to attack the Muslims. And I shouted that, take refuge to the mountains. After 1 month, the army, the Muslim army, which was led by a person called Sariya, they went back to the city of Medina, and they said that on the very day, on that Friday, on the same hour, they heard a voice like that of the second caliph, which was shouting, Sariya, Kuh, Kuh, and the army of Muslim, they took refuge in a mountain, and they overcame the enemy. So this is one story talking about the fact that according to this narration, the second caliph also knew the knowledge of the unseen. Let me just share one more narration in Sahih Bukhari. It's been mentioned that Sahih Bukhari, volume 4, page 200. According to this narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted to have said, among the children of Israel, there were some people that they were muhaddath, meaning that they were not prophet, but the angels talk to them. And if we have such a person among my nation, that person would be Umar ibn al-Khattab.
Yeah.
Commenting on this narration, Nawawi, one of the greatest Sunni scholars, says that the meaning of muhaddath, those people that are talked to, is those people that receive a kind of inspiration and the angels talk to them. So you see, we want to, of course, we do not want to say these are true narrations, I repeat that. But the point is that these are all the facts. The angel talked to Maryam salamullah alayha, and this is for sure, because this is in the Quran. The angels talked to mother of Musa alayhi salam, and this is true because it is in the Quran. The narrations of the Sunni scholars tell us that it's not limited, ilmul ghayb is not limited to the prophets, rather others may also have the knowledge of the unseen. So you cannot claim that the story of the mother of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is rejected because it involves Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam having the knowledge of the unseen.
Very true. And the range of the witnesses that we have for those who had the knowledge of unseen is too wide that cannot be actually denied, whether in Sunni sources or Shia sources. So the number of people who have been actually introduced to have the knowledge of unseen are not few. So this is not something that can be easily nullified and denied.
That's true. At the end of this question, I would like to mention one important point about the mother of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. Although we have this difference among the Shia scholars, whether she was from Rome or she was the slave girl of Hakim al-Khatun or a black slave girl, there is no about the fact that the wife of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, who was the mother of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, she was a very virtuous lady. She was a slave girl, and there is no doubt about that. Why we have such differences? Because of two reasons, maybe. One is that at the end of the day, she was a slave girl. Especially at that time, it was not something common for the historians to write about all the slave girls who used to live in the houses of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. And second of all, which is more important, is the fact that the house of Imam al-Hadi and the house of Imam al-Askari alayhimus salam were under high control and supervision by the Abbasid caliphs.
Yeah.
So even the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam happens in a very miraculous way. I mean, his mother does not show pregnancy for...
This is the next doubt, Sheikh, actually, which was posed again, with regard to the signs of pregnancy that was not shown. And they say that it is impossible for a person, for a lady, not to show any signs of pregnancy. And that's another case that they can raise against the existence of Imam of the Age and also the issue of Mahdaviyah.
Wherever you be, you're the one, my heart is to meet you.
My point here is that why some of the details about Lady Narges or Melika are not known, because of the fact that the house of Imam al-Askari and Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam were controlled by the Abbasid caliph. So it is very natural for us to not have much information about the mother of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam and the details about her lifetime.
Yeah, based on the doubt that I just mentioned, and it was seen also in the critics of this brother, is it really something, again, exceptional that when there is no sign of pregnancy in a lady, it can dismiss and it can deny the whole story? It just came to my mind when Lady Maryam salamullah alayha became pregnant on Isa alayhi salam while she had no husband. How can they justify that? If there was the will of God on that issue, then the same will can actually can be applied in this issue as well.
Yes.
But regardless of this, is there any way just to answer this doubt?
Okay, when it comes to the period of the pregnancy of Lady Najis Salamullahi Alayha, this Wahhabi scholar, he mentions that the story of her pregnancy is even more weird. She compares that to the story of her coming from to Arabian Peninsula. He says that the story of her pregnancy is even more weird because she showed no sign of pregnancy.